Welcome to Hallow Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. Dwelling with God in the New Jerusalem on the day of the Lord demands unshakable faith, not just temporary obedience. This study explores one of the lessons from the biblical festival of Shemini Atzeret, the convocation of the eighth day after the start of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. The Messiah's supreme authority, discussed in Hebrews 3 and 4, grants forgiveness to the repentant, while the unbelieving remain excluded, as noted in Revelation 21. Eternal life in God's presence requires a lifetime of trusting His unseen purposes, not just outward compliance. The choice is ours, to believe and enter His rest or harden our hearts like those of our spiritual ancestors in Israel, who refused to enter God's rest, the promised land.
Since the eighth day is designed to focus our attention around a few basic core fundamental ideas, we have Revelations 20, 21, and 22 that cover the basic Sukkot concept, how we're dwelling with God and not dwelling with God. We all kind of, that picture kind of makes sense to most of us. We read this for umpteen times over our lifetimes, I'm sure. But anyway, the attention to detail of that section is designed to get your idea, your mind, imagination flowing. What does that look like? What could I do? What does life look like in that scenario in life? And so we've been spending roughly seven-ish days during Sukkot, not dwelling with God per se, but dwelling in a temporary booth type space dwelling. That was the idea. And I talked about this the first day when I was up here about the humble concept behind the sukkah itself and the idea of remembering where you came from, who you are, where you're going, that type of idea. So we discussed a little bit about that at that time. Well, the end of it isn't like that. So, for example, when you imagine a sukkah, you imagine or see one that's pretty simple. Simple structure, nothing really fancy about it, has some stuff, these things there, little decorations, plants, twigs, whatever. When we focus on the kingdom of God and Jerusalem, do you imagine it looks like a sukkah to you? No. Nothing like one at all. Yeah, it's a huge, massive city, right? A huge thing that looks that's very decorative, very beautiful in its design and how it's structured. It is definitely a city to dwell in, to live in on a permanent basis. And the idea is a contrast between your sukkahs, which are dwelling in these sticks, to I'm not dwelling in sticks anymore. I have this permanent place that is mine to dwell with God. That's the imagery we get, which is good. We should have that imagery. We want to have that imagery. God wants to have that because we are very tactile, real people. We could touch and feel, we experience things as a real thing, as opposed to a just conceptual idea. So we have that imagery in our minds. Does it mean Jerusalem has to have bits and pieces of these rocks and stones in it? That's not relevant. It's not really relevant whether it looks like it's, oh, this rock is this big and that one is this big and this one's... Who cares? It doesn't matter. The point is, it's decorated as a dwelling place between you and God, and God to dwell with. That's the idea behind it. I contend, personally speaking, is that that's made up of human beings, not necessarily physical structures of objects. That's my Daniel Agee's personal opinion. Don't agree with you on that. I happen to believe or perceive that Jerusalem itself, the intent of design, is made up of human beings, as opposed to a physical, dimensional city that is this cube of massive size that plops the side of the earth like a big, massive pimple. A huge thing that looks strange. It's not that size. It's just some big thing, right? I contend it's more inclined to be symbolic of human beings because we're supposed to be God's cherished possession. We're it. We are what we are. We're supposed to be what his desire is. So I have questions for you. You don't have to answer these, but consider them or think about them. These are somewhat rhetorical, but a few will be required answers, meaning spit out what comes to your mind. First of all, before I get there, I have to have this basic foundation I want to cover a little bit. We all are on the same page to work with as we're going through our talk today. We didn't read Revelations 20, but it does talk about this because it's more geared towards Sukkot itself and the days leading up to Sukkot, which we call Yom Kippur. The idea of resurrection, right? That's where that Yom Kippur comes from. And the idea of that you have now cleansed, you're not like your flesh anymore, you're now a spirit being. That's the idea of Yom Kippur. And we get that from Revelations 20 story leading up to this 21 and 22. talking about the two resurrections, right? We have the two separate resurrections. Those one who belong to Messiah and God initially, some spent a time lapses, and then those who were not comprehending who or what God is, they get their opportunity chance at their second resurrection opportunity. So we have that basic foundation of two categories of people. I'm going to write this up here. So we have category number one and number two. We have this first category is intended to be those who belonged to God or selected to follow God in their walk while they were alive, right? And we're not talking about just any human being. It's a particular category of people that God has designated out to be in that group. I won't say who is and who is not part of that group. That's not my business. That's between God and the individual. But whoever they are, this is their category of group. So these individuals are supposed to be with Messiah for some period of time. I do realize our text says 1,000 years. I do also note that our prophets do not say 1,000 years. So there's some confusion on what that actually means, where the dates start, when they end. It's a little bit fuzzy, so I won't tell you what it is or isn't. But if there's some period of time, under the Testament claims 1,000 years, roughly, that this category is resurrected and belongs with Messiah and tries to, I guess, in other words, conquer the world or whatever you call it. And then there's the other category, which is the post that time slot where everybody else falls in, which is what we classify as, I guess, regular people. Yeah, regular is unleaded. Yeah, sure, that sounds good. Regular individuals who did not necessarily make a decision to follow God or Messiah while they were alive. This is a group of people who would have died at some point in time, could be from Adam till today or whenever this day happens to take place. Any groups of random peoples that are grouped in there, as according to Revelation 20, they are judged based on what they did. So we get this misstatement in some groups of followers of God that says your actions don't matter. That's not true. Your actions are super, super ultra critical throughout your whole life. Because this whole category, and I do not know the number of people in there, they are based, judged by God the Father on their actions, what they did versus what they did not do. All right, so these categories over here. This guy over here is based on their decision to follow Messiah, which is also an action. So action still is focused on both groups. They just focus on what type of action they're dealing with, right? The different actions being chosen. So this group over here, this 1,000-year reign, these are the, I guess we'll call them the ones who choose. What do you call them? We'll put choose up here. They made a choice in their life while they were alive to do something specific that was unique to them and God. So these groups of people are what we're talking about when they're dealing with and addressing the idea of dwelling with inside of God's new heavens, new earth, new Jerusalem. It's these groups of people. Now, we're not discussing the ones who failed, whose actions God weighed and said, yeah, you're not going to make it. Get out of here. Those, unfortunately, do not get to dwell in Jerusalem. I can't speak to them on their choice in life. But those are those categories. I have my personal opinions on who may or may not belong to that. Doesn't really matter because it's just an opinion. Anyway, so these groups of people who are going to be dwelling in this Jerusalem, which is a very large structure or some kind of place, which I get into course, as I mentioned before, is a description of human beings, not necessarily God, not necessarily a physical structure, but rather of people. And I get that philosophy, that idea, because of what the apostles and Messiah were talking about individual people being the objective and the apostles being the foundation stones and that kind of concept. It's a metaphor, the idea of a metaphor about a physical structure associated with human beings to build upon. We all build upon each other, don't we? We actually build upon each other's knowledge, wisdom, experiences, don't we? Well, by doing that, you became part of somebody else's foundation or growth, didn't you? Yes, you did. When somebody asks you a question or experience in life, I'm struggling with something. And you say, oh, well, I don't know how to fix it, but if I were in your shoes, I would do da 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 da. You just contributed to their structure, whatever it looks like. They may choose a follower or not. That's not your problem, but you contribute to it. So we all build upon each other at some level. That's why I contend with also a few of the passages also talk about this, about that human beings are the primary components within inside God's temple or structure or Jerusalem. Anyway, Let's be on that a little bit. So in this category, we have this interesting scenario. So these people who get to choose to be part early on, and the ones later on who are regular, who are judged to be part of it, which is totally fine. There's nothing good or bad about one or the other, just who they are. In this scenario, how do I, Daniel Agee, or Jimbo Schmo, decide what I want to do? How do I decide? How do I get to choose? How do I choose this category versus that category? What makes me fall into one group or the other? We discussed this before about making choices in life, right? For example, if I choose to do something good or choose to do something bad, those are choices, aren't they? And Moses also instructed all of us that he's giving put before us two choices. Choose life or choose death. These are two choices in life. You choose one or choose the other. What you do in life dictates which one you just chose. Whether you chose to follow God's instructions, you chose life. Choose to ignore God's instructions, you chose death. It's your choice, and Moses warned us he would like to us choose life, but we have to choose it. It's up to us to choose. But there's an interesting topic about here discussed in Hebrews 3 and 4 about this exact problem, which we'll get to a little bit, not yet, we'll get to shortly, about the issue of that just making a choice isn't quite sufficient. And Hebrews 3 and 4 discuss this problem of making a choice isn't quite good enough. And he compares, the author of Hebrews, I know some contend it was Paul, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, I don't know. He compares the decision of the people coming out of Egypt. Let's imagine for a minute, all you all were living back in Egypt with Pharaoh and the slaves and, you know, building stuff and, you know, whips and everything else. Imagine yourself there at that time in life. You have plagues going about you. There's horrible things happening all over the place. Everybody's confused and scared. Except this one old guy is saying, don't worry, just do these various tasks, live in this space, put some blood on your posts, you'll be okay. Yeah, you probably don't know a whole lot, do you? I'm being realistic. You don't know very much, do you? You don't have the Torah. You don't have great hindsight. You don't have great extensive knowledge about what God has told Moses. You are an ordinary schmo sitting there doing your thing. Yeah, you may get whipped occasionally or whatever happens with your taskmasters, but you don't have a lot of detail of what's actually happening, do you? All you get is the observant of things around you. So how do you as an individual make a decision based on lack of extreme lack of information? How do you make a decision when you have virtually no information to work with? What's your decision then going to be based on? It's not information. What's it based on? Trust. You have to believe, because trust is the foundation of faith. Trust is faith. Actually, it's faith is a noun, trust a verb. Anyway, doesn't matter. So trust, that's what that is. You're going to trust something that you don't actually understand, isn't it? So you're going to trust and do something that you don't comprehend. You're just doing it. How many of us have always asked the question, why? Why are we doing that? Yeah. Who doesn't? Right? We all ask why. You tell me to do this, well, why am I doing that? I should do this, well, why? We always ask why. What happens if we don't get the answer of why? We end up not doing it. That's who we are. We say, okay, it's not important. I walk away. See, the detail of trying to make a decision based on no information or minimal information is very difficult, isn't it? We tend to make the wrong choice. We have no information. I say I do. I don't know about the rest of you, but I do. If I have no information, I'm just guessing. My guesses aren't so good. My bosses will tell you that. I make mistakes on the guess, okay? So guesses aren't the best choice. I have to trust them that I don't comprehend. So while I'm dealing with this scenario, Hebrews 3 and 4 discuss this problem of doing something without comprehension and just trusting it. That's the category that these individuals here have to actually make the decision based on. Now, I'm not saying the people who in this thousand-year choice don't have any knowledge. They do, but the knowledge of it is very limited. How much of our Bible discusses the idea or concepts after the resurrection and events take place of all humanity? A very small sliver. Our Bible is missing all the information that happens after that event. Has a few chapters here, there, and that's it. We're done. Well, that's not much to work with, is it? Contrast that to our Bible's discussion of prior to those resurrection events. The entire book covers that. We have lots and lots of information of people's choices in life. So these choices we're going to make and discuss today are fundamental to us, but yet we make them based on very little information, right? It's based on either what you see, what you experience, or what you've been told. That's basically what it is. So let's head to Hebrews chapter 3. Now, I realize that Hebrews covers a large percentage of topics focused on the Yom Kippur, as well as other topics with regard to the fall feasts. We're not covering every topic in Hebrews, but I need to discuss Hebrews a little bit because I want to cover a little bit more detail of Revelation 21. But I have to cover a little bit to base the foundation of these two categories of individuals. Hebrews 3, there is an interesting warning going on with the author of Hebrews as he's trying to describe this to us. Hebrews 3, starting in verse 1. Oh, by the way, this is also, he uses Psalms 95 as a proof text here, which will be part of it, but not say all of it. So Hebrews 3, starting in verse 1. Holy brothers and sisters, partners in heavenly calling, take note of the Messiah, Jesus, who is the apostle and high priest whom we confess, who is faithful to the one who anointed him, as Moses was also faithful in God's house. For he has come to deserve greater glory than Moses, just the builder of a house deserves greater honor than the house itself. Every house, of course, is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God. Now Moses was faithful in all of God's house as a servant to testify to the things that would be spoken. But Christ is faithful as a son over God's house, and we are of his house, if in fact we hold firmly to our confidence and hope that we take pride or confidence in. Pause there for a minute. So the two categories being discussed here. We have Moses over here, and we have Messiah over here. Now, faithful over a house. Imagine a minute, you are a king. You really have lots of stuff. You got mansions and vineyards and whatever else. And you're going to take off for a while. A couple years, 10, 15 years max. And you'll be back. Who's in charge of your house? You better have a very good, trustworthy chief master servant who's in charge of your house, aren't you? But besides, discuss this possible problem in a few parables. About a master leaving and the servant who does a good servant or not so good servant, right? The ones who are obedient to the master and the ones who are not obedient to the master. Who are you going to put in charge of your house? Sammy, someone you trust in charge of God's house. How do we know that? Moses gave us the instructions. Now imagine for a minute, you're the master, you left. You're on some business trip. It doesn't matter what it is. You're off doing something else. Now imagine for a minute, put yourself out of the master's position because you put somebody else in charge. Now I'm going to put you back into the house. The master's gone. You're back at the house, but you are not the chief servant. You're a subordinate. Let's say you sweep the floors. Okay, that's your job. You sweep the floors of all 5,000 rooms every week. That's your job, okay? You got a team working with you, however big this mansion is. You aren't in charge of the house. You just sweep the floors. The chief servant is in charge of that house. The chief servant is instructing you on how to properly sweep the floors. Who inspects your work since the master's gone? The chief servant does. He or she inspects your work. Did you do it correctly? Did you do it as I instructed you to do? And your work may be inspected, or you may have either other subordinates working with you, co-workers we call them, or even people beneath you. You might be a manager of some form of sweeping this house. Well, this chief servant also has responsibility of taking care of the grounds, the outside. Not he himself, but he's in charge of people who do that. And of course, obviously, the buying and selling, the business that's involved, the master's business at home. The chief servant is responsible for all of those tasks. In place of the master, the chief servant doesn't get to make decisions the master would not give him authority to make, right? Let's say, for instance, a bad chief servant comes along and says, the master's gone. Okay, everybody, we have a 15-year vacation. Okay, when the master comes back, will he be thrilled with this chief servant or not? Probably not, okay? Or if the chief says, you know what, we're going to move. We're selling everything. We're moving in the shack across the street. Make lots and lots of money. Master goes back, he has a shack to live in. That's all right, we're all good, right? The chief servant doesn't make decisions the master would not give him authority to make, right? But who would? A son does, because a son speaks to the master, right? So the master says, okay, chief servant, you're still in charge of the house, but the decisions you do not have the authority to make, my son will do in my place. And the master leaves. Now, the chief servant would say, hey, Daniel Age did a bad job sweeping rooms 1,017 through 3,043. We should fire him because he's incompetent. Find a replacement. I come along. Okay, yeah, I screwed up. I didn't do a good job. I was tired. There was a good song and I kind of got busy as bebopping and not paying attention. My mistake, right? Well, the chief servant does not decide whether or not I get to stay and overrule the master's laws, does he? The master says, hey, if he fails this, he's kicked out. That's a chief servant's job. He failed, kick him out. The master can overrule the servant, chief servant, but so can a representative master known as a son. Son can also overrule a chief servant. So chief servant's given certain responsibilities. That's our task, Moses. Given certain jobs. This is your responsibility. It's what you can do. Master, he's gone. Son can overrule chief servant on certain scenarios. Not the chief servant isn't responsible. Son gets to overrule certain scenarios. When the master returns, son has to give account to that overruling, doesn't he? Well, yes, he does. Because chief servant has to report. Hey, master, so-and-so, Daniel did a bad job with these 2,100, whatever, a lot of rooms. Bad job with all these rooms. I was going to fire him because he failed at it. But your son overruled me. Master goes to son. You overruled him. Why? Master decided to explain. I overruled because of whatever reason. It was my fault, his fault, whatever. Somebody did something wrong, and it's okay. He repented. He's doing a better job now. He has that mistake since. Great. That's the job of a master and chief servant and son's responsibility. That's their relationship. That's classic, by the way. The classic relationship has been around for a few thousand years throughout the Middle East as well as Europe. That's pretty standard procedure. There's nothing fancy or unique I just described to you. Now we're discussing in Hebrews, though. So we have this master, that chief servant was Moses, and of course, Messiah put his faith of a son over God's house. So as God is out of the way, busy doing something else, whatever that is, I'm not going to argue. The son's job is to handle the scenarios the chief servant is not responsible to do. Chief servant cannot forgive someone who fails at something. It's not his job. He's supposed to enforce the master's rules. The master or the son can forgive, but the chief servant does not forgive. That's not his task. He just reports what's right, what's wrong, do this, don't do that. That's the chief servant's job. So we have the scenario. We have the chief servant Moses, and he was categorized as in charge of God's house. We know that because God said so in the book of Exodus. Moses in charge of my house. This is what it is. So we know that God put him there. So Moses, chief servant, Messiah, of course, come along as a son who takes the place of master for tasks that the chief servant Moses is not responsible to do or cannot responsible to do. We have this there. Continue on in verse 7. And therefore, as the Spirit says, this is a quotation of Psalms 95. As the Spirit of the Lord says, oh, that today you would listen as he speaks. Do not harden your heart in the rebellion of the day of testing the wilderness. There your fathers tested me and tried me, and they saw my works for 40 years. Therefore I became provoked at that generation and said, their hearts are always wandering, and they have not known my ways. As I swore my anger, they will never enter my rest. Pause. Now we have a problem. So we have a scenario being described here in Psalms 95, being repeated here in Hebrews 3, about a category of a group of people who failed. I just said, the guy who, like me, who failed to sweep the rooms correctly for 2,000 some odd 100 rooms. I've been called out. I'm a failure. Yes, I admit, I failed. I wasn't very good at it. I was tired, whatever. I have my excuses. I failed at that. And that's where I'm at. So he's coming, and God is now saying, they're out. I'm kicking them out. Daniel, here's a boot. Boink, gone. That's it. Okay, nothing else. I'm done. I'm history. I'm over with. That's kind of disappointing, isn't it? Anticlimactic, like, oh, I screwed up and I'm gone. That's a lot of people get screwed up and gone. As a matter of fact, 600,000 roughly Israelites got screwed up and gone as God booted them for 40 years. You're out. That's what he's saying. I couldn't handle these people. I'm not going to deal with you. I'm booting them out 40 years time over that time span. They all get booted. So we have this grouping. Now, this is where the warning comes in the author of Hebrews, verse 12. See to it now, brothers and sisters, that none of you has the evil, unbelieving heart that forsakes living God. But exhort one another each day, as long as called today, that none of you may become hardened by sin's deception. For we have become partners with Christ. In fact, we hold our initial confidence firm until the end. For as it says, oh, that today you would listen as he speaks, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. Pause. So, there were a lot of rebellions. Now let's put me back to the scenario, my 2,000 rooms I failed to do. What if my excuse was, you know, chief servant Moses, I don't like sweeping. Matter of fact, I hate it. I'm terrible, I won't do it anymore. Not only will I not do it, I'm going to throw this broom right at you and say, you do it yourself. Am I in good graces with Moses? Probably not. Okay, I had a job to do. Now, on top of that, not only that, I'm going to say, Moses, I hate this house. I don't like this place. Too much work. I'm done with it. I want to go back. There's a hammock outside. I'm going to hang on my feet up there. I'll talk to you in a couple of years from now. When you finish the job, Moses. Now, am I showing honor to my master? Not at all, am I? But see, that's the kind of condition that we're discussing here. The people coming out of Egypt, how many of them were all thrilled and wonderful? Yes, good riddance, Egypt. Yay, one God. I'm going to follow all of his commandments. The whole works, no mistakes. Yeah, like two, maybe three. Moses tried pretty good. Wasn't perfect, tried. Joshua did pretty okay. He didn't do so great all the time. No one succeeded at it. They tried, but no one succeeded at it. They all fell short, right? That was the weakness. So we have this scenario. We have this Moses. Okay, Moses, you're in charge of the house. And I, Daniel, have chosen to kick back and relax and say, forget you. I'm done with this master thing. He can have his own house. He wants it swept, clean himself. Type of attitude. That's a rebellious heart, isn't it? I'm rebelling against my own master, the chief servant. In this case, obviously, the son too, but we'll discuss that in a minute. But this category. So just because I was included in the evacuation of Egypt, does that mean I get included in God's kingdom or his house? No way, not at all. Being included in the evacuation of Egypt, or in modern day terminology, of being a Christian, doesn't mean I get included in God's house. There's actually responsibilities I am responsible for. Number one, I have to fear that master, don't I? If the master returns and sees me on the hammock, okay, back and forth, eating a, you know, drinking some cocktails or whatever, had a good old time. He returns, says, yeah, those rooms didn't get swept, Daniel. Do you really need to sweep them? No one was in them. Yeah, they did. Because I didn't respect the master. Now, obviously, the son has the option, he's in master's place, to say, to boot me out before the master arrives, boot me out of the hammock, say, go, here's a broom, go get the job done. He could obviously do that. Moses would not have the ability. He would just say, hey, master, he screwed up. Get rid of him. Okay? I have these options, these scenarios in front of me. So Moses has this responsibility of making sure that I understand as a servant, go sweep the rooms. Go do your job. That's his job. Chief servant's task. His job is to tell me how to sweep them, give me the supplies I need to sweep them, and instruct me how to get the job done, like the actual tasks and responsibilities are included. Messiah's job is not that. That's Moses' job. Messiah's job is to handle things that Moses cannot handle. So Moses comes along and boots me out of the hammock. I go over to, hey, master's not around, but hey, Moses just said, I should have a water. Give like a wet rag. These are dry. Yeah, I forgot these aren't dry erase. I should do a better job with my drawings. So Moses says, hey, this dude screwed up. Daniel's hanging out here on the hammock, not doing his job. And now the Messiah can say, Daniel, you going to do the job or not? I got to decide. Am I going to do the job or not? And if I tell him the one in place of master right now, the Messiah, tell him, son, no. Is he going to vouch for me for the master then? No, he won't. I have to actually trust something, don't I? I have to trust that master will, in fact, return. What if I believed he wouldn't return? I'm good. Doesn't matter what I do. Doesn't even matter. Now I have a lack of belief. See, all these are complex things to discuss, but Hebrews actually talks about these topics. We talked about these topics, and this is what we're discussing today. So I had this issue of decisions to make in life that even though Moses be the chief servant in charge of God's house, I have a decision, do I follow it or not? And when I got tired and sat back in the hammock, when I'm brought before the master's son, the master says, son, hey, you gonna do the job now or not? I had choices to make, decisions to make. I had to decide, what am I going to do? Am I going to stay on the hammock, or probably get booted off anyway, am I going to try to stay on the hammock, or go do the job I'm assigned to do? Those are choices. And that's what we're discussing, the choices. So in this scenario, back to Hebrews 3. Let's go there. So let's see. For which ones had heard and rebelled, verse 16, was it not all who came out of Egypt under Moses' leadership? And verse 17, against whom was God provoked for 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, those whose dead bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear they would never enter his rest except those who were disobedient? So we see that they could not enter because of unbelief. What did they exactly not believe? Did they not see they went through the Red Sea? Sure, they saw that. What did they not believe? What is it that they were saying, I don't really want to follow the master's rules. What were they not believing? Moses, they didn't believe Moses, possibly. Actually, see, since all the information came through Moses, yeah, they probably didn't believe Moses. Didn't believe the son. Didn't believe there were truly, my argument, Daniel's opinion, argued they wouldn't believe their actual consequences. Think about it for a minute. They came out of Egypt. What was Egypt's life like? Hard sex everywhere. Everything doing anything imaginable you can think of. Yeah, all pagan whatevers, you can really grotesque things, in fact, in some instances. That was normal culture. Egypt did okay. They're fine. See, there's a lack of actual belief that that my actions truly matter to this master of mine. Isn't the belief that God existed or not? That wasn't necessarily their problem. No one argued that God didn't exist. They disagreed that Moses interpreted correctly. They thought he didn't interpret because they didn't believe the instructions that Moses was feeding them. They didn't believe it mattered. That's their unbelief. It's the same as saying, me coming along, saying, there is no God, right? I can say, I could argue that. It's absurd. Don't get me wrong. it's a lack of belief in something, isn't there? Does it change what my life is like? I have a wife, I have kids, I have tasks, responsibilities, bills to pay. It doesn't change. But my lack of belief, I don't believe there's a consequence to the actions I follow. That's a lack of belief. Not a lack of me existing, lack of belief. So just because I get included in this category of people coming out of Egypt with Moses doesn't necessarily mean I get included in the grouping of God's people. As people of Egypt found out, Israelites found out for the 40 years, all the adults were booted out, not included. So just coming out of Egypt doesn't make me included. Just doesn't. There's something I have that the additional responsibility I must have to come out of Egypt. It's more than just I got out. I have to do something. My actions matter. My belief in what my actions are and that they matter is also super, super, super important. If I don't believe my actions matter, will I continue doing them? Let's mention for that you have a job somewhere. Your employer says, sit in a chair over there. Does it matter to anybody that you're sitting in a chair? Well, my boss said so. Okay, I'll sit in the chair. All day long, I'm sitting in this chair. Bored of my mind. 8 hours sitting in this chair. I would intuitively think, clearly, my point being here is worthless, right? My actions are not being relevant to the company I'm working for. I'm doing nothing good. Just sit in a chair. And I get up, say, you know what? I'm done. I quit. I'm out. I leave. Now, what he didn't tell me was he was testing the chair. He wanted to see if it would break. How comfortable it was sitting there for 8 hours because he's a chair manufacturer. I didn't understand the reason for the action, for the order. Therefore, I interpreted it with my own eyes, thought it doesn't matter. In fact, it did matter to the employer. He had a job for me to do, and I failed to do it. So my actions may not appear to matter in my mind, but the one who ordered them, it does matter for whatever reason they may be. So the Israelites coming out of Egypt, as far as they were concerned, their belief system, oops, wrong button, their belief system of whether their life mattered and what their actions did, how relevant it was, didn't matter to them. They thought it didn't matter, but it does. It does, in fact, matter, even though they may not necessarily see that it matters. Tammy.
If you knew that you were being paid $100,000 a year just to sit in that chair, even if the boss did not maybe do a good job in telling you your job parameters, all of that.
All the details, right.
All the details of it. The fact that if you knew that he was paying you $100,000 to just sit in that chair for 8 hours a day, even if he didn't do a good job telling you why, the fact that you were being paid a good amount of money to do it would have been a different signal to you saying, maybe I don't understand why this is important,
right?
But it's important if he's paying me $100,000 a year to do it.
Exactly. That should be the logic thought process of people coming out of Egypt. God spent all this time, the 10 plagues, these massive miracle, crazy things. He thought it was so important to do this. It should be enough to say, wait a minute, I may understand why, but that's like crazy, miraculous, crazy stuff. That should be enough to tell you whatever God's doing, he has a reason, I don't comprehend it. But that lack of trusting in that because I don't comprehend it, therefore I won't do it, that's the screwy thought process. But that's what they went through. That's exactly what they did. They actually went through that process. I'm not going to do it. So when they make these choices in life, when I make choices in life, or you make choices in life, just because we don't understand all the reasons of why, does not change responsibility to make that choice. I'll sit in that chair, whether I understand or not. I'll sit in the chair someday, trusting he'll explain to me why I'm sitting in the chair. Maybe he will, maybe he won't, but I trust someday I'll figure it out. So that should be enough an indicator that there's a reason for this. God spent a lot of effort making all of creation, didn't he? A lot of effort. Look around you. That's worth something. Why did he spend all this effort to making creation if it was just a joke? There's a reason for it. So even though I don't understand all of it, I don't have to understand it. It's my trust of doing it. So going back to Hebrews chapter 4, sorry, verse 1. Therefore, we must be wary that while the promise of entering his rest remains open, none of you may seem to have come short of it. For we have had good news proclaimed to us just as they did, but the message they heard did them no good, so they did not join in with those who heard it in faith. For we who have believed enter that rest, he has said, as I swore my anger, they will never enter my rest. And yet God's works were accomplished the foundation of the world. For he has spoken somewhere about the seventh day, and God rests the seventh day from all his works. But to repeat the side of the text earlier, they will never enter my rest. So he's contrasted that God has a rest. It existed, has always existed, and it's always been promised to be shared. And that was his argument. But yet the people at the time didn't comprehend that that was of value to them. That A, they could even, it'd be value to them to begin with, but also B, they could actually get part of it. So they didn't trust that was actually real, that there's actually a purpose behind this. So we make choices in life, even though we don't necessarily understand the choice itself, the idea to choose is the critical point. Now go back to Revelations. So understand the reason why, even though we don't understand it, the choice matters. Now, Revelation 8 mentioned there are two categories of people. We have these ones who choose, and the regular Joes, Schmoes, what do you call them, didn't choose. Chose something else in life, didn't comprehend. Understand that God was limited, whatever. There's lots of excuses. It doesn't make a difference what their excuses were. They didn't make their choices. In those instances, they're judged by their works. The books are opened, as it's described in Revelation 20, and they're judged according to what they did in life. Okay, now let's be the next category now. Groups of people. You know them, I know them. Who may or may not believe in a God, I don't know. But some of them, action-wise, do good, don't they? Some of them, action-wise, do bad. What about those people? That's what that category is for. Those whose action-wise, overall, we could debate what is and is not good, but overall in God's view, whatever this category good is, he says, we've done good, you've done bad, and now we can judge you based on what you did was good. What compels someone to do good who does not know God? Any ideas? The conscience, that's a good one. They have some purpose, some desire, some built-in communication, understanding that there is some value in doing good to somebody else or for someone else or even themselves. So that's an important player. So if we have these categories of people, they also have their opportunity, according to Revelation 20, that they will be included in that groupings. Even though these guys, not the same as this one, their own category, their own group, but they still get included into God's kingdom. So again, this all based upon the idea that even though these same people came out of Egypt, just like we came out of Egypt, we may have made a choice to follow God. They may have made a choice not to follow God, but they still have their actions in life. There are some good ones and some bad ones, some better than others. Some were like Korah, not so great, right? Some were like Zelophehad, not so bad, but not great either, kind of in between. We have these in-between categories of people, which God said, you're not entering this time, but that doesn't mean you won't enter next time. We have these categories. So now we have these two categories of people. We understand a little bit more about them. The ones who choose, either they comprehend or not, makes no difference, they choose anyway. And the ones who made decisions in life based on their conscience or their idea of what was fair, just, or kind to other people, and they live their life that way, even though they may have made mistakes and not comprehend God at all. We also have the category of Moses in charge of instructing what is true, what is right, how you do your job, what your tasks are to do, how to do them correctly, and what is not correct. Here are the supplies to do them. We also have the Messiah filling in for the master, overruling any scenario that comes along that Moses says, Daniel's sitting in a hammock again. And the son says, it's okay, I talked to him. We'll handle this when the master returns. So we have this category. We have all these characters being played out within Hebrews as well as Revelations. Now let's go to Revelation 21. So Revelation 21, which was read earlier. Technology, getting used to this stuff. I'll never be as far as Jeff is, but I'll get used to this stuff. So Revelation 21. My notes go back to this page. So this is a replay or a variation of Isaiah 65 and 66, but it's mostly the principles are the same. So verse 21, I saw a new heaven and earth, is verse 1. If the first heaven and first earth had passed, it ceased to exist, and the sea existed no more. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, sitting out of heaven from God, made like a bride adorned for her husband. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, the residence of the God is among the human beings. He will live among them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them. He'll wipe every tear from their eyes. The death will not exist anymore, or mourning, or crying, or pain. The four things have ceased to exist. And the one seated on the throne said, look, I am making all things anew. Let me write it down, because these words are reliable and true. He also said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha Omega, the beginning of the end. To the one who is thirsty, I will give water free of charge from the spring of the water of life. The one who conquers will inherit these things, and I'll be his God, and he will be my son. But the cowards and unbelievers, detestable persons, murderers, sexually immoral, those who practice magic spells, idol worshippers, and all those who lie, their place will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, and that is the second death. So now we have God coming along, discussing to John, because it's obviously a message to John, he's the one who's writing it down. But this new place that God has set for, though they didn't understand, this group gets included into it. This group who based on their actions, gets it included into it. Those who chose not to base their actions, I really liked, having sex with anything that walked. Okay, get out. I don't want you. So we have these groups that God says, hey, I've made this category, I've made these people, I've made this place for them to dwell, and now I'm going to include them in. That's our target. You had a comment, Larry?
Sorry.
That's all good.
I keep thinking about, you were talking about before, the prince, right?
Yes.
The son.
Yes.
Who, in the absence of the king, can make decisions, and even they're as strong as the kings.
Yep.
And king will support those statements as if he had made them.
Correct.
And we got him in here too, right? And it's true that he... These people over here could talk to him and when they're in trouble and get out of that trouble. We call that grace.
Right.
Even though we have to actually ask for it, I think, before we get it. But
you plead.
If he says, okay, yeah, you did some good things for me that I don't know how the king would not know about that.
And it's a metaphor.
Yeah, right.
It's a metaphor. It's not actually like God knows everything.
Okay, you just sit tight. I'll talk to him. We'll get it done. But I'm thinking how close that metaphor actually works to our system, because we do have our Messiah over and over again talked about you'll get rewarded according to what you do.
Yes.
And he said over and over again that you must repent, which has to do with your actions, right?
Yep.
So that's how closely he is involved in that, and he can make all of those decisions in the name of the Father.
Yes.
And
That's why Messiah used the metaphor himself. Who discussed the parable of the master with the servant, and the servant the servant was a wicked servant. Oh, the master like tons and tons and tons of money. I can't remember the parable off the top of my head, but and the servant begs master's compassion. Okay, fine, I'll forgive you. Oh, it was an obscene amount of cash, and the servant goes off, and then like for a small amount is like ready to kill this other guy because he refuses to pay him back. So it's that relationship of pleading for the master, or in this case, obviously son as well, pleading. That's the tool. That's the example we're given to use. And that was smart. It was a good solution. So that's the metaphor is used in our Bibles multiple times for that exact reason. It's a really good metaphor. It works really close to how the relationship is supposed to work in that instance. And of course, God had said, because Messiah successfully did all this, I will listen to him. I will accept his judgment, whatever it is. The Father said so. Okay. The Master said so. Okay. It's what it is. The Son's smart. The Son knows what the Master wants. He knows the objective. He knows the goal. Not that the chief servant does not comprehend the Master's servant or Master himself, but the Son knows him better. That's how it's supposed to work. All right. So you have correct observation. That is correct. That's why the metaphor is there. It's for that reason. So we can really relate as a human being what this looks like and how our relationship with God and Messiah actually work. So we can have a good personal relationship with that and to make that function well with us. Does that make sense? Hopefully that's how I view it. That's why I think that's why it was used. So because we can more easily approach an individual who has struggled. That's the right word, tested. This is what the Bible uses. With the same scenarios and weaknesses that we have. And that was the idea that to test the same problems that he overcame and we didn't, but that's the idea. Anyway, let's move forward a little bit. So where was I? Oh, right. Okay. So we just read this, verse 21, discussing this scenario. So God made all this great stuff. Hey, look, all these people are coming, all these things to move. And the note that says the residence of God is now among people. What does it tell us the ultimate objective, God's the Father? What is the ultimate objective? To hang out with you and I. Now, I'm not that good of a person, but he thinks I'm good enough to hang out with. Go figure. You are too. Go figure. I don't know. For some reason, he said, we're cool to hang out with. And that's what he wants to do. That's the objective. That's why I contend, one of the reasons I contend, that the temple of God, this new Jerusalem, is made of people. That's his goal. Hang out with people. For some reason, he likes us. Okay, even David marveled. Why? I don't know. But for some reason, David said, you like us and I can't understand it. But some reason you do. And some reason, yeah, he's right. David's right. God does like us. And I don't know why he likes us, but he likes us. So he made us. Okay. That's good. That's his goal. That's objective. So he chose to hang out with us and it's done. Of course, I'm beginning and all that great stuff. I mean, everything. Well, verse 8, the cowards, unbelievers, the sexual idolaters, all those great things, bad things, are all kicked out. They don't get to hang out with God because he hates those behaviors. We're all tested on him. I'm not saying every single thing, every single time, but we all have our tests, our weaknesses in some of these areas. So it is responsibility again, that even though, whether I was part of this group who chose to follow God or part of this group who did not understand God, but did some good stuff, some bad stuff and tried to figure it all out, I have a responsibility. If I make it through to God's kingdom, I have responsibility. Guess what? I don't get to be a coward. I don't get to be an unbeliever or a detestable person, murder, all these great, horrible things that people do. All those are done with me. I'm done with them. I don't participate in them anymore. Or if I ever did, I don't know. But that's the idea behind it. So, and of course, continues on. I'm going to skip this part that I just read about the whole, the description of what Jerusalem looks like, a bride door for husband. There's lots of stones. And yeah, I get Isaac. Some of those words are harder to pronounce than others. They're a little complicated, but I will jump through those a little bit. How it's laid out, of course, its size. Again, the dimensions are a little bit odd. I don't understand the full dimensions. I know people have their imagination, what it's supposed to look like. Good, jump down to verse 21. I saw no temple in the city because the Lord God, the Almighty, powerful, and the Lamb are its temple. So now we have the dwelling house of God in this city he built. I'm going to draw it a square. It could be rectangular. It could be all these different things. I don't really care. It's whatever shape it is, a shape. So massive shape. It's rectangular in appearance or somewhat squarish in appearance. I don't fully understand all the natures because God's, that the tabernacle itself was rectangular. When Moses made the tabernacle, it was rectangular, and here it's square. Maybe God likes different shapes, who knows? Anyway, some section of it, which we would normally say that's the temple, John saying, nope, it doesn't exist. Why does it not exist? Well, it's in heaven, but the whole space, what was the function of the tabernacle, the temple itself? What was its purpose? Why did Moses make it? House for God, right? So God could dwell, you should turn dwell, with the people, amongst them without being too close, because we would die. Okay, that's our weakness, right? We poof. So, but at this point in time, it's not required anymore. So that's taken care of. So instead of being a temple, he takes over the whole space. So no isolated position, which means those who enter this new Jerusalem, guess who they get to see? The Father. That's pretty impressive. As opposed to the temple, which you could see the outside curtain. You kind of, if you really had a tall ladder, you might be able to look over. I wouldn't advise that, by the way. It's just not a wise choice. But unlike the temple, which you could possibly look over, maybe on a tall hill, I don't know, looking down at maybe. But in this instance, that's not required. You deal with God directly. Again, that was God's objective. It was all objective all along. So we have this promise, this belief that our choice in actions and obedience and what our mistakes, Messiah is saying, it's okay, I'll take care of this. I'll vouch for you as long as you go back to sweeping the floors like you were supposed to. I'll vouch for you. I get to then walk through those little gates. How many gates? The 12 gates. There are three each side. Oh, whatever. Bunch of gates. I'd walk through and I get to hang out with God, with my creator, which was his objective all along. So do I believe that? Again, what did Hebrews say? If you don't believe it, it ain't going to happen for you. If you don't believe it, it's not yours. It doesn't matter what you did or didn't do if you don't believe it. You need to believe it's real. That's a hard one. Being honest with you. Look around you. Look at the world. It's hard to actually manifest in my mind and belief in that. Not impossible. It takes work. Think about it. That is really humanity that great that God would say, yeah, I want to hang out with you. I mean, look around. Some. Not all that many. It's pretty rough out there. Right. It is rough. But God still said, I want to hang out with you. I don't believe that there is something more that God sees that I don't see in the people around me, the humanity around me, that I can't come here. I say, just kill them all off. It's not worth it. Where's the nuke button? Smash. We're all done. Game over. That's the instinct, like, this is just not worth saving. It's not worth it. There's no real value here. But God's saying, no, Daniel, you're wrong. What you see, what you comprehend, just sit in the chair and do what I told you to do, Daniel. Okay? I can't comprehend the value of it, but that's my task. I have to believe there's a purpose to this, that at the end, of something good will come out of this. I mean, understand or see it. I have to believe that's true. If I believe it's true, I'll stick with the chair. I won't walk away. I'll see the past, say, wait a minute, my employer, my God, did all this stuff for me. There's got to be a reason for it. But I can't understand the why. But I have to believe it's still, there still is a legit reason. There still is a purpose behind it. If as long as I trust that, I'll persist and stay in the chair. If I don't trust it, I'll walk away. And I'll be the same as the 40 years of wilderness, the Egyptian out of Egypt. And he said, give him the boot. I'm done. That's a hard decision to make in life because I don't understand it. But I have to know I don't have to understand it. As long as I trust it. There's value here. I'm a little over time. I'm at time. So like a couple of verses and I'll call it quits. Let's see, God lights a lamp. Oh, so God, verse 23, the city does not need a sun or moon to shine in it because the glory of God lights it up and its lamp is the Lamb. The nation will walk by its light. The kings of the earth will bring their grandeur to it. The gates will never close for day and there will be no night there. They'll bring the grandeur and the wealth of nations into it, but nothing ritually unclean will ever into it, nor anyone who does what is detestable to practices falsehood, but only those whose names are written in the books, the Lamb's book of life. So, okay, side note, I find that interesting because in Isaiah 65, we have this category of flesh and blood human beings still hanging around, living long lives, you know, hundreds and thousands, whatever years, long time, right? In this dwelling place of God. So it's like, okay, that tells me it's not that all this stuff is all a bunch of spirits doing just spiritual things. We have human beings too, which I think is fascinating. Because human beings get to walk into here too. Like, whoa, that's weird, isn't it? And we have this point that unless you're obedient, unless you're worthy to walk in, you don't get to walk in. But human beings get to walk in, which that's kind of cool. I'm really curious what that looks like when all is said and done. I want to see what that looks like. Because that's my, wow, how that happened. Anyway, that's Daniel Agee's like eye-popping, I want to see human beings walk through these gates and see what God does. I'm really curious. Yes, Shay. Oh, Anne, I apologize. I didn't notice that. Go ahead, Anne.
I guess at this point, I wonder, did you say the 1,000 years or 1,000 people?
Years, sorry. I have written my grouping. I kind of slipped the tongue. It was a 1,000-year group, that group category. I'm not referring to 1,000 people.
I guess I get a little confused about the separation of the goats and the sheep, you know, and how the Lord separates those that were not unbelieving and the degenerate or regenerate, right, didn't get regenerated, and the believers, you know. Mm-hmm. So how will the dead, will be the dead in Christ and the dead that are unbelievers, I mean, that will be part of the new world, the new heaven and the new earth, where do we fit in other words?
So your relationship with God is between you and God. I don't have knowledge of your relationship with God. So you are you. So you have to make a decision in your life Right.
You know, after
on this life while you're still alive, while you're still around here, you make decisions in your life. You've made decisions throughout your whole life, you've made choices. All these different choices in life. Good, bad, and different. All different choices you made in life. Every day of your life, make choices. So when you or I or anybody else choose, say, I'm going to be obedient to my God, whether I understand him or not, I'm obedient to my God regardless of whatever happens to me. Think of, for example, Daniel's three friends, right? The three guys in the furnace, right? Regardless of what happened to them, they said, we're going to believe anyway. Even though I may get burned up in this furnace by Nebuchadnezzar and get toasted and shish kebabbed, right? Whatever. Whatever happens, it's okay. I'm going to believe anyway. That's a decision to make. It's a hard decision too. Moses would probably, you know, be a little questionable about that. Is that really what I want to do? But that decision is a hard decision to make, but they chose to make that choice anyway with Daniel's three friends. So that choice is a choice they made while they were alive, knowing it would probably kill them anyway. But trusting, even if it did kill them, they weren't going to change their choice. Those are choices we make. And that's a good example of that choice making. Even though it's a hard choice, may result in your personal destruction, you choose anyway. That's referred to on people on earth make those choices. Now, for the people over here, for those who did not understand, did not know, but still weren't evil human beings. But Apostle Paul read across a number of them while he was talking to Mars Hill, I think it was, discussing that there are some good people here in Greece who have no comprehension who or what God is. Well, how would he say that? Why would he say that? Because there were. There were good people who didn't comprehend who or what God was. And he recognized that. There are not everybody who doesn't believe in God does not make them an evil, you know, destruct, hell raiser type of human being. They can still be a decent human. That was Paul's observation. They still be a decent human if they don't believe in God. So that's the category that we have our second resurrection we discussed with. That was discussing earlier. So in this grouping here, as your question brought out, who all is there? Yeah, it consists of this group as well as that group. Now, I can't say who's doing what in there, but they both, according to our instructions in our Revelation story, they get included. They get to come. Now, I don't know all the details. I don't have to know them. I don't have to comprehend them. I just know that's what it says. So that's what it is. Make sense? Right.
Practice magic, arts, yep, and sexually immoral, murderers, idolaters, and everyone who loves and practice falsehood.
Right.
So that sounds like hell to me. I mean, right.
Exactly. The category of the people who don't get to go in, here's a border, I guess, so you argue it. The ones who are amongst the category, we'll call this, so the regular groups were broken into two. Those who said, okay, who were halfway decent, I guess, however God split them up. So we'll split a big line across the middle of it. So this section, a little circle here, don't get to go in. Okay. That section did get to go in. I don't know how big they all are. It doesn't make a difference. That's what he's trying to describe there. It's described actually twice in our Revelation. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, outside of the presence of God, and there's no opportunity anymore for presence of God, would be hell to me.
I agree. That would be a very unpleasant experience.
You know, I mean, we'll all be at this point. This is future. The correct. Future is the new Jerusalem.
Right. Whenever that is, yes.
Right. So, I mean, it's after tribulation. Some people think, well, we won't have to go through that, but I tend to think we're nearly there now. And then when we pass away, our spirit will go on, and we will be working with the Lord there.
Heaven will be there.
We want to be workers.
That's my objective.
Right, in the kingdom.
That's my objective, yep.
Okay, so that's the kingdom.
Right. The category down here is that it would be God's Jerusalem territory, his new Jerusalem that he produces.
The picture of it is in Ezekiel about the four square, the whole big thing.
Yep, Ezekiel has a great detailed, his scale model is much, much, much physically smaller than the Revelation's scale model by extraordinarily small numbers in comparison. So I this is where it gets really fuzzy when you deal with a metaphorical God giving a metaphorical vision to John versus a metaphoric God getting a physical vision to Ezekiel. When you deal with God in metaphors, it gets really wonky. It just does. Because he doesn't see things the way I do. I see this as a marker. I have no clue what he thinks it is. It could be a sword for all I know. I don't know. What God sees, what I see, are not the same things. I can't look at things like he does. So it's very complex to deal with Revelation's section, because you're dealing with God, dealing with metaphors through to John, for John to understand them in human terms and write them down in language we can comprehend. It's complex. I realize there are like a billion and one books about it, and they all disagree with each other because they can't, nobody can really make true sense of all of it, because it's really complicated to figure out. The metaphors are not easy to see, and they weren't supposed to be easy to see. If I knew that, you know, I don't know, some person here in Revelation was, you know, Jimmy number five outside, knew that was the right guy, said, here, this is Jimmy number five, then I would say, oh yeah, you're Jimmy number, you're this guy. It's easy to see. But if I'm not told that, I'm not talking about Jimmy number five, I'm talking about, you know, I don't know, a tree, I would have a harder time. So metaphors are not easy to comprehend, especially when God's one giving them. But this is pretty straightforward. What's being described here is like really like literal, not literal as far as physical size, but as far as how it's being described here, it's pretty straightforward. Nothing really fuzzy about the last two chapters at all. Shay, her hand up.
Okay. So then our role would be distinct from those who you called regular folks.
Right.
In that we would be made kings and priests.
Theoretically, yeah. Theoretically. We have a responsibility of
we
some form.
We have responsibility
whatever
as opposed
responsibility
to those
is, yeah.
who on the second resurrection
would have a different one or less.
Had less
whatever.
Responsibility yeah. or maybe they needed us to bring them into the kingdom, because you have the Spirit and the Bride saying, come.
Yep.
Come and receive the water of life freely.
Gotta get the message out somehow.
Yeah. Yep. So, and then you said that there were humans at that time.
As so, Isaiah records people, human beings around. And okay. even this Revelation implies there are people, because you have this tree produces all kinds of fruit designed to heal the nations. Well, spirits don't need healing. I don't get a wound, owie, give me some, yeah, I don't need a Band-Aid.
But
I'm
also
a spirit.
It said at some point that death would be no more, but then if there's humans, are these humans eternal humans?
And that's been a debate with my mother and myself for probably 25 years
that's
now.
That's a concept I've never
heard
of.
Because we disagree on what that looks like, and because we have no clue.
Because I assumed that those that they were calling into the city were actually those who were the wicked. Imagine a child who's beaten mercilessly his whole life, sexually abused, grows up, he gets dragged into some, you know, sex trafficking thing.
Right.
And he's just saying no, no, no to God all the way up to the resurrection. He has no, his conscience has been so seared.
Yeah.
Then he's gets thrown into the second death, seems to be actually the presence of God. Mm-hmm. It's brimstone, it's sulfur, it's for the purpose of cleansing, not for the purpose of destroying, to bring into reconciliation and restoration.
Depending
in the
on
presence
the person,
of God, so that then when they're ready, when their hearts have finally, their conscience has been by God's mercy and grace in the presence of the Lamb, have been healed, and then the Spirit and the Bride say, hey, come, then they can come.
That's a possibility. Without knowing, because I mentioned before, from the resurrection point onward, very little is taught to us. Very, very, very little. So it's really fuzzy to know what that looks like. I do realize there are people who have been ruined by other people. They are ruined. And I don't know how God deals with them. Right. It happens, yeah. There are children who are aborted, who had no choice in the matter, right? What happened to them? I don't know. I just don't know. Because God had the capability and the decision, and he did, with Egypt, all these plagues, and the Israelites, for the most part, were exempt from them. He must have the ability to handle complex scenarios that I can't handle. Because I don't know how you would have, you know, darkness everywhere except this one spot, or locusts everywhere except over here. Yeah. How? The locusts don't do that. They go everywhere. So God can do things that I don't understand how he does them. So I can't explain how that looks. It's pure speculation. I don't know. But it is a hope. It is hope. And my mother and I, we discussed this topic, or used to, not so much anymore. She got a little older, but we used to regularly on this topic. I'm over time, but I apologize. I want to finish this real quick here. Revelation 22, angels show me the river of water of life, water as clear as crystal, pouring out of the throne of God and of the Lamb, flowing down the middle of the city's main street. Each side of the river was tree of life, producing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding fruit of every month of the year, leaves for the healing of the nations. I mentioned before, that's how healing of nations, healing of people, that's human beings. And there will no longer be any curse, throne of God, Lamb will be in the city, servants of worship. Jumped a little bit, verse 4, they will see his face and name will be on their foreheads. That's a throwback to Ezekiel chapter 9, which is that those who trust and mourn for the misery that's in this world, he would mark those individuals as his. Ezekiel 9 discusses that topic. The angel goes through them first, marks them first, and the God said to the other angels, okay, now kill everybody else. Those people spare, kill everybody else. So we have these individuals, again, are those who have their signature written on them prior to the destruction, this category, this grouping over here, prior to destruction, God's signature is written on them. So that's this grouping. He's saying those are ones, so they will see his face and his name will be on their forehead. So those people, or spirits, I guess, get to see God's face. That's pretty cool. I'm looking forward to that point. And of course, we'll go through it. We won't go through all this, but we have this scripture. We're going to end now. I won't finish the rest of chapter 22. But discuss all these details about how you conclude and ending this story. I want to say there's a salutation ending here, which is the right word is not intuitive. Those who are wicked stay wicked. That's weird, right? Why not just tell them to repent? Those who are good stay good. Okay, well, yeah, that's good. But there's something there that I, Daniel, do not understand.
I don't know.
I don't know what the objective or the goal would be to say those who have been evil, keep being evil. My speculation, I don't understand it, is that they are the ones who are choosing, whichever side, this side, to say, no, I don't want to change. That's my speculation. Because I don't understand it. That's why all I could do is speculate. But it's a strange, maybe it's too late. There's something about them. They've made a decision. They're sticking with what they choose to do. And I can't say what that looks like. It's a curiosity more than anything for me. Anyway, so I apologize for a little overtime. Any comments or questions over this? Yes, Larry.
I'm not sure how, but it might make this more obvious. Is like in the King James Bible in Romans 3, when he talks about in all the other versions that I've read, it says faith in Jesus Christ. In Romans 3, in King James, it says faith of Jesus Christ. So in other words, that means, I can't rule on which one's the best, but that is supposedly is a genitive clause there, when it's talking about faith of, meaning that the faith is his faith, not our faith, but his faith makes it possible for him to save us.
That would be valid. Faith is a trust base. That's the word for trust. So he has faith, his faith. He's trust that God granted him. So God's granted him trust to do so. So God's trusting his decisions. Therefore, yeah, that would lit. That's legit. That's a legit argument.
So my son, you can rule in this case.
Yeah.
You can request the ones that you want.
Yep. You can choose them. Yeah, because he's the master is trusting God, is trusting Messiah as, I trust you'll make the whatever decision is right is good, and I'll hold to it. I will stick with it. Yeah. There's a trust level that God has granted him that he did not grant to Moses to make those decisions. So yeah. So God's saying, I trust you. Trust to make this choice.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.